Our practice has these two general phases. One is that we often open to wonderful experiences, to insights, to expressions of our awakened nature. And then on the other hand, we often have experiences where essentially we experience what covers over that awakened nature. We often call these second sort of experiences difficult experiences. And there's a kind of a rhythm where both are occurring. And those are generally what happens. So when we have difficult experiences, it's not like something is wrong with our practice necessarily. It's really a pointer to something that we need to learn to see more clearly, some habit or some challenge. And even when we have experiences that are unexpected, we can work with them. And I know for myself, in my own history of practice, I imagine this is similar for you, there have been both kinds of experiences. When I first was practicing, I think after about a year of doing about 2 hours a day of practice, I was a student, so I had a little more open time in some ways. And I did a retreat, and I had some amazing experiences, and had deeper levels of calm and concentration that I had ever known. Sort of the energetic body opened up, which was unknown to me before that. It's like, whoa, look at that. Mysterious. And I think in a way I was, one could say it in different ways. One could say I was hooked. I was committed. And I think especially in retreats, I had probably the next retreat or two, very similar experiences, very positive, inspiring, leading to a sense of commitment and depth and wonder and awe. And I think after that, then there was a retreat or two which were not like that. One of them I remembered was primarily fear. I think 10 days of fear. And a lot of it was around kind of seeing, how I couldn't really control things. And there were things happening that were scary and I couldn't control them. And something was really difficult about that. But there was enough faith, enough previous experience, and I think good guidance, so it became a learning experience. And that's our hope, really, because we have both of those kinds of experiences. There's no way around that. After my first year or two, when I had primarily these positive experiences, I actually thought that the talk about dukkha and suffering was for other people. And then fear came. And that's the rhythm of our practice. We have both. And again, it makes total sense. We can have some inspiration and insight when we see certain things, when we get to a certain level of calm.
Oh, crap.
When difficult things happen. Yeah, I can do the handheld one.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Temporarily. This is not the most difficult thing that's ever happened as a teacher.
The batteries.
So this, is this working? Okay. So that's a rhythm that's there in our practice. And it's very natural. And sometimes after a while, we may have a sense that the difficult experiences are actually chances to grow. I think at the end of that fear retreat, I had a sense that this is, that there was learning happening. And I could have that attitude of staying with it, because I was actually, even though there was fear, with enough mindfulness, I was really able to look at the fear. And there's a lot of learning. I was looking at the fear, and I, some part of me knew, this is all based on illusion. I have an illusory narrative in my mind, and it's not really the way things are, but I was still hooked into it to some extent. There's a beautiful text, it's actually a very interesting text that I like very much, from the Buddha. It's a famous text, it's called The Simile of the Saw. Anyone know that text? It's quite a famous text. And it's, let's see if I can read it and also hold this microphone at the same time. But it concerns a woman named Kali. No, not Kali, Vedahika. She has a maid named Kali. That's a sign that something bad's going to happen. Okay. So here's the Buddha telling the story. There was a housewife named Vedahika, and a good report about Mistress Vedahika had spread thus. Mistress Vedahika is kind, she is gentle, she is peaceful. Sorry. Now she had this maid named Kali who was clever, nimble. I'm just reaching back. Is it not working?
It's not. No, it's dead.
Okay. So, Kali thought there are good reports about my mistress, that she is kind, gentle, and peaceful. How is it now, while she does not show anger, it may be present in her, or is anger really absent? Suppose I test her. So she got up late. Vedahika said, "Hey, Kali, what is the matter that you get up so late?" "Nothing is the matter." "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl. You get up so late." She was angry and displeased and scowled. The fact is, Kali thought, that while she does not show anger, it is actually present in her. And just because my work is neat, she shows no anger. Suppose I test her a little bit more. This is a minor test, right? So she got up still later, and Vedahika was angry and displeased. Then she thought, the fact is that while my lady does not show anger, it is actually present. Oops, wrong one. It is actually present. And that was how she got up still later in the day. You know where this is going.
Yeah.
Okay. She got up still later. And then, what is the matter that you get up so later? "Nothing is the matter, madam." "Nothing is the matter, you wicked girl, yet you get up still later in the day." She was angry and displeased, and she took a rolling pin and gave her a blow on the head and cut her head. Then Kali, with blood running from her head, denounced her mistress to the neighbors. "See the kind lady's work. See the gentle lady's work. See the peaceful lady's work," and so forth. At this point, the Buddha steps in, makes this comment. "So too, some practitioners are very kind, gentle, extremely peaceful, as long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him. But it is when disagreeable courses of speech touch him that he can be understood whether that practitioner is really kind, gentle, or peaceful." So, in a way, when we get when things happen to us, we get tested in a way. And that can be quite positive. So you can reframe it the next time something difficult happens. One's being tested, one's being challenged. And sometimes, you know, I know you read the lives of practitioners. I was reading from accounts of Ajahn Chah, you know, the teacher of Jack Kornfield, Achan Sumedho, Tanisara, and others. And he has an account, he tells the story of when he was a monk, and he knew, and this was strong in the Thai culture, he knew that he was afraid of ghosts. It's very strong in the Thai culture. And he said, I want to get rid, you know, he said, I want to face that difficulty head on, so to speak. I want to test myself, I want to grow stronger, I want to go into a difficult area in order to grow. Anyone do that sometimes? Mm-hmm. We can do that. We can take perspective. I know what occurred to me when I was thinking of that was a period of time, still sometimes the case, where I'm in an interpersonal situation or a social situation, and there's some fear about speaking something truthful. I start shaking. Anyone do that? Yeah. And for me, when I feel that shaking, it's like a certain point in my life, I said, when that shaking occurs, I gotta go. I gotta speak, right? And I took that on, right? And we can take on these challenges. It's a way to approach the difficulties. Achan Cha chose to sit in charnel grounds after people died. And sit there all night. And for people from Thailand, that is the last thing anyone would want to do. But he felt that he still had that conditioning. And so there's stories of him sitting all night. Once he sat all night, and he kind of got through it gritting his teeth. It was after a small child died, and he said, okay, done that, let's go. But he realized there was still fear. And so he stayed another night, and someone else died, and he actually... That night he had an apparition appear to him, you know, like a fearsome apparition. He stayed with it. His fear got totally intense. We would say the reptilian brain was on overload. He stayed with it. Something exploded and he burst into this amazing awareness and the fear was gone. It was actually predicated on him really trusting the idea that there's something in him beyond life and death. And so he sat with that and he said that it opened up to something that was powerful. So we can take on these tests. Last time, I talked about six ways of working with difficulties. And I invited people to take the week from last week to practice with them. How many people, at least some, looked at difficult experiences and tried to take a different perspective. Great, so it looks like about half the group who's here. And I wanted to briefly review that. And some of you know who were here last week, and I think there was an email sent out that the topic was motivated by the fact of having had a break-in at my home and working with that and what came up. And I'm not going to talk so much about that. Last week I talked more about that, but I wanted just to review those six aspects and then take it a little further and give some further ways to work with this. So the six perspectives that I offered for working with difficulties, the first could be said to be work with a teaching or a transformative perspective. Bring that to mind. In other words, and last week I gave the core teaching of the two arrows as a very fundamental teaching that can guide one when something difficult, painful, unpleasant happens. It's basically, the teaching, as you know, is about how we tend, when there's something painful, to react and push it away as if that would help, where it actually tends to make things worse. The teaching of the two arrows. And so find a teaching that can guide you. You know, for me, one thing that occurred to me was sometimes with interpersonal challenges, really reflecting on the causes and conditions both of our situation and maybe what's there in the background of the other person, as well as myself. Kind of reflection on causes and conditions and interdependence. That can be part of what's helpful to look more deeply. You know, and even sometimes in very extreme situations, people use teachings. You know, most of us know that, you know, have heard stories of Tibetan monks, teachers who were in Chinese prisons, often tortured. You know, and one teacher I heard of, he said he continually remembered a core teaching that he had received, similar to the two arrows. And this, it's a teaching that goes like this: when the container and the contents are full of negativity, and there's a lot of unpleasant stuff happening, transform adverse fortune into an awakening path. I think that's a different translation of something I gave last week. Turn all obstacles into the path of practice. When there are difficult things happening, now, easier said than done, but to remember that, he said, guided him in prison. And it was of tremendous help to avoid negative things happening. The second guideline that we looked at was to develop mindfulness, especially to know what was happening, to be able to know this is happening, simply to tell oneself that. That sets in motion our wisdom, our compassion, our skills. If we're not mindful of what's happening, we'll probably stay somewhat stuck. So the second pointer was being mindful in two ways. One, knowing what's happening, and secondly, exploring what's happening. Exploring one's mind and body and heart when there are difficulties. Not what we usually like to do, right? Usually when we do that, we might be thinking, if I just use mindfulness enough, this will go away. Anyone ever do that one? But here we want to actually be open to what's difficult, to what's unpleasant, what's painful, and explore it with mindfulness. Third guideline was learn when we're out of balance or when the difficulty is too much, a number of ways to come back to balance. Really crucial. Sometimes we can't be mindfulness. Sometimes we can't be mindful, I should say. Sometimes we can't be mindful because we're out of balance, we're too reactive, we're too overwhelmed, and then we need ways to come back. So we explored that some last week. Have a repertoire of ways to come back to balance, ranging from talking with friends, doing something physical, being with beauty, using a form of meditation that can shift us out of it, like loving kindness when it's strong enough, traditionally understood as an antidote to fear. Have a repertoire of ways of connecting with community, you know, doing something physical. I used to go to difficult faculty meetings once a month, and I would always right away go swimming, do vigorous exercise after difficult meetings, and I found the physical exercise was more dependable than meditation for bringing about calm after difficult circumstances. So we know that, you know, we know we can take a vigorous walk and so forth. One of my students, when he used to have very difficult thoughts come up in the morning, he was working a lot with James Barrows' Awakening Joy class, and he would do joy practices. And it would be like shifting the energy, much like with metta. He would shift to joy, and the negative patterns wouldn't be there. This is when they're too much, right? And they're a lot. A fourth one was to continually look deeper into the difficult experience, difficult pattern, with the potential of really seeing habitual patterns. The mindfulness, and this is really a way of talking about deepen the mindfulness so that we can actually see patterns. Sometimes we can see what we call limiting beliefs, almost like hidden patterns that generate some of our negative habitual states. When we stay with it deeper, we can start to see those. And the fifth one that I gave last time, again, is a little more general. It's continue to practice in ways that keep on developing awakened qualities. We might even focus during difficult stretches on, I want to develop patience, or I want to develop compassion, or I want to develop equanimity. And we can really have a focus on developing these qualities and finding ways to do that, both meditatively and non-meditatively. And then the last one I gave was learning better how to work with speech and be interactive with others when there are difficulties happening. Again, especially that could mean noticing one's tendencies to take things out on others when things are difficult, to use unskillful speech, to blame others, to blame myself. That could, you know, noticing those tendencies. And we can actually use speech, much like we use meditation, to point ourselves in the direction towards qualities of compassion, empathy, wisdom. So that's what I gave last time. And those were some guides for practicing during the week. And this week I wanted to bring in a way of deepening that practice with one particular teaching that I wanted to bring in. And this teaching, I think many of you know, this is the teaching called the Eight Worldly Winds, or the Eight Worldly Conditions. And this is a very wonderful, simple, but powerful teaching that can give us more depth on working with challenges. And these eight worldly winds are eight states of mind, four of them pleasant and four of them unpleasant, that knock us around. They're sometimes called the eight worldly conditions. In the Pali, the term is loka dhamma. So loka is a word meaning worldly, something like that. And dhamma could be translated in various ways, conditions. Some people translate it as dharmas, you know, like that. But anyway, I like the translation. It's not really a translation, but the worldly winds that blow us around. Okay, so here they are. They're familiar probably to many of us. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and disrepute. Fame could mean a good reputation. And the last one is praise and blame. So you see they're pairs. And generally speaking, the pleasant ones knock us around by leading to our grasping, and the unpleasant ones push us away around by leading us to push away. Okay? And the teaching comes directly from one of the Buddha's discourses. It's called the Lokavipatti Sutta. And I think I'll give it. The language is actually very, very similar to the language of the two arrows. If you remember, last time I gave some, I think some readings from the two arrows teaching, where the Buddha more or less says, everyone at times experiences the unpleasant. How does a practitioner differ from a non-practitioner? And you'll hear similar language more or less saying, everyone experiences these eight conditions. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner? So I'll read part of the text. These eight worldly conditions keep the world turning around. And the world turns around these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. For an uninstructed person, there arises gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. For a well-instructed practitioner, these also arise. How are the two different? That's what he does often. And then he said his answer was, gain arises for an uninstructed person. That person does not reflect, gain has arisen for me. He does not reflect, it is impermanent, liable to lead to dukkha and subject to change. That non-practitioner does not know it as it actually is. And he goes through the other seven in a similar way. With such a person, gain, loss, and so forth consume that person's mind. When gain comes, that person is elated. When there is loss, that person is dejected. That person will not be free of dukkha. Usually translated as suffering. I like to translate it as reactivity. And now he says, gain arises for a well-instructed practitioner. That practitioner says, gain has arisen for me. It is impermanent, liable to lead to dukkha, and subject to change. That practitioner understands these conditions as they actually are. With such a person, gain, loss, and so forth do not consume that person's mind. When gain comes, that person will not be elated, and when there is loss, that person will not be dejected. That person will be free of dukkha. This is the difference between the two. Gain and loss, fame and disrepute, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, these conditions among human beings are inconstant, impermanent, and subject to change. Knowing this, the wise person, mindful, ponders these changing conditions. Desirable things don't stir the mind. Undesirable ones bring no resistance. The persons welcoming and rebelling are scattered, gone to their end. Knowing the dustless, sorrowless state, that practitioner discerns rightly and has gone beyond becoming to the further shore. So taking to be a very central practice. That's from the text of the Buddha 2,600 years ago about these eight. So it's really an unpacking of what we looked at before, the different variants of pleasurable experiences and painful experiences. But it's a very good teaching because we can take that and look out for these eight. We can ask, which of them hook me the most? Which of the eight? What do I get most hooked by? What do I get most grasp onto? We can take these, put them on your refrigerator, remember them in the morning, let them guide you. It's a wonderful practice. It's a practice which helps tremendously with working with just small-scale difficulties. Ultimately, it's a practice which points towards balance and equanimity, the ability to be in a non-reactive way with what comes up. And we only train for that by seeing how we're reactive. And again, the reactivity can mean both grasping and pushing away. And we can ask, how much is my happiness dependent on having gain and avoiding loss, having pleasure and avoiding pain, having a good reputation and avoiding a bad one, and having praise and avoiding blame? The teaching is that the deepest happiness is beyond those conditions. That's what the teaching is about. But I like it more, especially, I was going to say more because it points to things we can look for in our experience. That's why I think it's so helpful. So I'll say a little bit about these, talk about some ways to practice, and then I want to finish on the early side so we can talk about what we might have found last week. Because my favorite part of the teaching role is talking about what's happening in people's experience. It's actually not giving talks. But giving talks is second place. Not bad. It's pleasurable. And I often gain a good reputation.
And praise.
And they're it's pleasurable. Sometimes not. Okay, so pleasure and pain. Again, very fundamental teaching. We can study it, but to notice, to use our mindfulness and to notice this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, really fundamental to our practice. A lot of us have worked with that. Can really, really help, because again, these eight winds just naturally blow us around. And we get hooked, something difficult happens, and one says, aw shucks, or some variant of that. Whatever, small or big. And we can also watch our reactions when there's something unpleasant. A little bit easier to study the negatives, right? To study the unpleasant aspects, but we can also notice, what's my attitude towards the pleasant? When something pleasant occurs, let me study my mind, my body. So it's a very interesting practice. Do it in meditation, but also do it in the flow of daily life. Have wonderful food. Say, let me look at pleasant. And again, nothing wrong with the pleasant. The teaching is not to avoid the pleasant. It's always the reactivity in relationship to it. It's always that. It's never to say pleasant is bad. but the grasping is problematic, right? So we can look at that. Watch how we run after something pleasant. Again, we can see this in all the different parts of our lives, how we try to avoid the unpleasant. What is the actual experience of pleasant like? What is the experience of pain like? What's going on in the body and the mind when they occur? It's a really interesting inquiry. What's really happening? You know, until I meditated, I had never looked at that. These are things we take for granted. Gain and loss, whether our own or that of others. What is it like to have a loss? I mean, it ties into the other experiences. In my own recent loss, I was noticing, you know, it triggers other things. I could notice a lot of unpleasant mind states, right? And a lot of sadness, right? And there are other things as well, but what's the experience of loss when there's some loss? What's the experience when something positive happens, when there's gain? Again, the problem is not that there can be some happiness. The problem is there grasping? Again, always distinguishing between those. Fame and disrepute. Look to what occurs when we think we have a good reputation. How much are we driven by wanting to look good in whatever part of our lives? How much are we driven to avoid negative thoughts about us, having a bad reputation? What do we have fears of not being seen? Right? We can really look at this. Again, it's to the teaching sets us up to look at, to use these eight and then see when the experience arises and study it, explore it. Really, really, really interesting to see. You know, some of you know the famous story of the Zen teacher Hakuin, I think from about the 16th or 17th century. And he was accused by a young woman in his community of having impregnated her. And there was a child that was born. In actuality, it was someone else in the community. Hakuin, according to the story, did not say, "You've got the story wrong." This is a Zen story. So. He did not protest and say, "That's fake news." He did not contest it. He did not say, "Let's look for the real person." All he said, according to the story, is, "Is that so?" when he was accused. And I think it took 5 years, and finally the real partner of this young woman came forth and said, "It was me." And Hakuin was, who had been reviled for several years, great Zen teacher, he then was asked, "What's your reaction to what happened?" And he says, "You know," he said, "Here's the news." And all he said was, "Is that so?" It's the story. I'm hearing that with some other like, sort of resonances in the time of Me Too, but it's interesting. And so we can look for where do I have self-image? Where am I trying to look good? Where do I fear looking bad? You know, one of my favorite stories about this is, it's kind of funny, it's a story from Jewish tradition of a day in the synagogue. And one day, the rabbi was very taken over by a sense of his own humility. And he went down on the floor and started speaking loudly and says, I'm nothing. I'm nobody. I'm nobody. And he inspired the cantor, who also got down on the floor of the synagogue and started repeating, "I'm nobody. I'm nothing. I'm nobody." At which point, the janitor heard them lesser status, got down on the floor also and started saying, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, I'm nobody. At which point the rabbi turned to the cantor and said, look who thinks he's nobody. So, need I say more about spiritual self-image? It occurs. It occurs. And then the last one, I think when I've worked with groups of people with these eight, we've often thought that praise and blame may be the most intense and powerful, right? That it can really have an effect, that praise can make us feel good, but especially we want to avoid blame. It's very fundamental. You know, maybe it goes right back to being 4 years old. And what we most want is praise and avoidance of blame from parents, right? And so really, really fundamental. And we can look at that. We can look at how that's still there. People sometimes say, as they get older, that they are less affected by praise and blame. Anyone who's over 50, how many of you experience that some? How many of you don't experience it much?
Reduction, huh? You mean the reduction of it?
Yeah, that you're not. How many people notice that it hasn't really lessened as you get older? Right. So, you know, very strong energy, you know, and I've seen that in myself and in others. One story I sometimes tell is that of organizing a summer institute for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and the organizers halfway through. We did a kind of a survey of how things were going. And I think we had 100 respondents, and 95 of them were positive and 5 were negative, and all of us zoomed in on the 5 negative and talked about it as an example of that. So how to practice with them. When they're there and they're overwhelming, use the tools pointed to earlier to try to come back to balance. When they're in the workable range, stay with them, try not to get rid of them, try to be mindful. Name them, say what's happening. Use the 8 labels and name them like that. Let that be a starting point for mindfulness. Study them. It's a really interesting way to work with the 4 that are more in the unpleasant and difficult range, but also probably we have done that more than look at the positive ones, right? Because there's going to be reactivity with both of them, grabbing hold and pushing away. And so take these as a starting point for meditation. Name them, explore them, be mindful of what they're like internally. It can really be a way to quicken our meditation. If our meditation feels a little bit dull or habitual, stale, taking on a practice like this is a really good way to give energy to practice. It brings in the factor of inquiry, which is really fundamental for deepening practice and giving more life to practice. Take these on and say, I'm going to look at these when they come up, and they'll come up in one's daily practice. One can also reflect on their nature, their impermanence, the fact that they're just occurring because of causes and conditions. Work with them in the spirit of equanimity practice, that I can learn to be balanced with whatever comes up. Equanimity is this powerful capacity to be non-reactive, meaning that we don't grab hold or push away of whatever comes up. So all this is a training for equanimity, it's a training for patience. It's actually a very simple but profound way to deepen practice. And so I'll close, and then we can open up to some discussion. We'll give 2 readings, okay? The first is from a Tibetan tradition. This is basically in praise of practicing with the 8 worldly winds or the 8 worldly conditions. There was a teacher of the ancient monastery of Retting, whose main practice was circumambulating the stupa. Drom Tompa, who was a great teacher, observing this, spoke to the other teacher and said, it's very good that you were circumambulating, but it would be better if you practiced Dharma. This one, the The other teacher thought to himself and said, circumambulation does not seem to be a very good practice. Perhaps I'd better read scriptures. Drom Tenpa told him, you are doing fine with your reading of scriptures, but it'd be much better if you practiced Dharma. So he thought again that perhaps he should concentrate on meditation. But again, he was advised that although meditation was good, he'd be better off with a pure Dharma practice. He had now no ideas about what to do. He asked Drom Tenpa, what do you mean by a pure Dharma practice? He told him, you should give up your attachment to the eight worldly winds, the eight worldly hopes and fears. This is pure Dharma practice. Okay, so here on August 5th in San Rafael, California, we have received what, according to this teacher, is pure Dharma practice. It's up to you. Okay, and so I'll close with a well-known poem which really captures also the spirit of this, what we've been talking about, which is Rumi's poem, The Guest House. Okay? I think many of you know this. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. That guest may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Let's sit for a moment. So we'll use the mic and again open for any reflection, question, and especially I'm interested in any reports of what you might have found in the last week with your practice, working with challenges or difficulties or unpleasant experiences, or anything about the eight worldly winds or any aspect of this practice.
I really appreciate the homework because it's very helpful to stay kind of like focused on all this stuff. Otherwise, you know, it's easy to just be kind of dismissive and to just do, you know, the habits. So I just noticed that that something that happened to me made me, you know, reactive inside, but I looked like I was responsive and I couldn't really engage or anything.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later, because I was paying attention, I noticed that what I have a habit of doing is that person dug me and now I'm digging them back.
Yeah.
And I reflected on it later and I thought, oh, that's an interesting habit. So I really appreciate just the noticing that and the homework around it.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's really, I mean, my hope is that this engendered curiosity about these very basic dimensions of experience that we might not have looked carefully at before. It's really, I mean, that's one of the, again, the simple wonders of our practice, that we can look with somewhat fresh eyes at something really simple and fundamental, and out of that, learn and deepen and gain insight. Yeah. Any reports from the last week?
I'm glad you brought up the pleasure and pain in the worldly winds.
Yeah.
Because I had a very painful episode this week, and I realized I needed to send metta to myself.
Yeah.
And I did, and it helped. Yet when it comes to physical pain, I have a quandary because I never know when it should be paid attention to and treated, and when I should just learn to be with it.
Mm-hmm.
So this debate is in my head all the time about, do you call a doctor and do you learn to live with it?
Yeah.
And watching that line in my mind is interesting, because I can go quite far with being with it, But then I notice my ego, that's another of your teachings, I notice the thickening of the ego when I want someone to pay attention to it, and I want sympathy.
Yeah.
And I notice that thick ego, and then I say, well, you need metta, it doesn't have to come from someone else, you can give yourself metta.
Yeah.
But it's really an interesting practice with pain.
Yeah.
Because I'm curious about how other people decide when it's time to do something about the pain, when it's time to just sit with it.
Right, so there are really two important points there. The first is that question of when something difficult happens. Now, we always want to be mindful, but I think the question you bring up is, if you know, when do we act on something difficult? You know, this teaching isn't about being passive. It's actually about being responsive, and I think you're right in that, you know, I mean, we do this in meditation. If we sit with an unpleasant sensation in the knee, we make a distinction between when that unpleasant experience is something that we can work with, live with, watch the mind, and when it's causing damage to the body. We generally don't act further if it's causing harm, right? And so the same thing, I think there is, especially with certain kinds of pain, a choice point there. And I think it's important to have some clear sense of when it's important to act and when I can, if I have, I don't know, some kind of sickness, when do I need to act on it and when is a matter of just being with what's happening and being skillful, right? So I think it is important to raise that question and to be clear in one's own mind as best one can. That's one point. And then secondly, just to notice when there is something unpleasant, it can be emotionally draining, and it can be difficult, and we want perhaps some compassion, some empathy, and sometimes it's skillful to ask that of other people, right? And to be able to, you know, I know in my own experience of the loss after the break-in, it was quite important to be able to talk and to not be too isolated in my own mind. Right? Very crucial. And so that's important, but then also very important to give that compassion, empathy to oneself. Both really. And so that can be really important in difficult circumstances to work with self-compassion. And again, there's a very nice book by Kristen Neff simply called Self-Compassion. Many of you know that, which has a lot of great material. And they're very simple meditations that are on the web, which are essentially about recognizing that there's something difficult, know that it's hard, know that everyone experiences it, and wishing some good thoughts for oneself in the midst of what's difficult. So, thank you. So in the back...
I love the eight worldly winds, so thank you so much for talking about it. And the last couple, 2.5 or more weeks, I've had some extra physical challenges. And I was really aware of how quick my mind was going to, I have cancer again. I have to go to the doctor.
Yeah.
Or this is laziness. I'm not disciplined enough. I mean, it was really interesting to see how automatically negative self-talk arose, and it gave me a practice for patience.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this and that happened. Maybe you're just exhausted. You know, your broken shoulder is still healing, and you're missing discs in your neck.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to rest.
Yeah.
So there was this dialogue going on, all day, every day. And it's been really interesting. So I've had kind of a patience acceptance practice with just inquiring, let me read the pharmaceutical insert for this new medication that I'm on.
Yeah.
So it's been really interesting. And your talk tonight just touched on all of that. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for that. And that, again, just that spirit of... not taking our own reactions as the last word, and noticing them, noticing the what the negative scenarios playing out, form of the second arrow, also understandable as the you know, the reptilian brain and the limbic system doing their thing, which is to scan the environment for any signs of threat to our survival, no matter how small. Right, and so, but we can say, okay, you know, calm down, it looks okay. But the main thing is to notice and then to explore and study and inquire and you know, take it as a starting point to look deeply, look as deeply as possible, rather than just to go along with it. Thanks. Okay, Ron and then Veda.
So thank you. This was really good. And I have a couple questions about
sure, a little closer, you know?
Teaching tonight. But
a little closer. Sorry,
yeah. I have a couple questions about the teaching tonight, but let me stay with what you're asking. So the combination for me was really powerful. A couple of us went just before this to a 10-day retreat with Joseph Goldstein and
yeah.
Something that I got at a much deeper level than I'd ever gotten before was whenever anything arose, rather than using it as an opportunity to get better at it, to simply observe it and notice what kind of thing it was rather than to go into it as a purpose,
rather than
to go into whatever the content was.
Yeah.
To have a more refined practice of really discerning. There are any number of examples during the week.
Yeah, maybe give an example so people can have a sense of what you're meaning.
So, you know, a deeper, more important one is we have a son who's going through a very difficult separation situation with this, hopefully, soon to be ex, who is, it's a very difficult situation. And I found myself giving a lot of suggestions. And I think I actually know a fair amount about this as my profession, and I know him pretty well, and I know her pretty well. And yet, I found myself getting pulled in ways that I was much more noticing what the subjective experience in myself was,
yeah.
And not liking it, yeah. Liking what I was doing and how I was doing it. And what's been really helpful to me has been anytime I find myself, this is such a complicated practice, every time I find myself having a particular firm idea about anything, I try to pause and pull back and see what is the other side, what am I not seeing,
mm-hmm.
What's not present. And especially in things that I'm clear about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how much comes up.
Mm-hmm.
More superficial was driving over tonight, just my reaction to traffic experiences. And one guy who cut me off. And so I got to see, you know, so I have the pull of do I react, do I not react,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But kind of like the do I take the pain seriously and see a physician, or do I abide with it? The practice that I'm playing with, I'm interested in your reaction to this, is like in the retreat, it's not to figure out what the right answer is, because another way of looking at it, I'm finding, is it's actually both. It's both proper to get retreated, it's also proper to abide. It's not trying to find the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's knowing that everything is actually both, and rather looking at the consequences of continuing effect of whichever I choose,
mm-hmm.
not just stopping with that decision, but where does it lead me? What comes up next? Because anything that's that complicated, whatever I choose in that given moment, I'm going to be confronted with the same thing over and over again. It's going to continue to be hard for me. So I might as well get used to the idea
mm-hmm.
of continuing to track. So that's
yeah.
a lot of stuff. But
yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm hearing particularly two points. One that you made initially, I think related to the retreat, is when something challenging comes up or emotionally charged, watching out for getting caught in the content and going to look at the process. In other words, what's occurring? Is that a thought? Is it a reaction? Is it one of the eight worldly winds? And so forth. So that'd be one thing. So we tend to get hooked by the content. And then the second point that I heard, maybe others, but the second main one was, even in terms of the content, being aware that when we get at the level of content, there are always opposing views. There are always different views. And sometimes to reflect on that can be quite helpful. So I'll kind of draw those two core lessons out of what you said. And I think then, Veda, if we have time for one more.
Okay. So I'll try to make this quick. So I've been aware in daily life of really unskillful speech and blame and judgment toward myself. Just really woulda, coulda, shouldas, and And from after, during the week, what I'm trying to do is actually bring that up when I sit.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can, in other words, rather than using my sit as a time to calm myself down, to really investigate that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you where I've gotten,
mm-hmm.
but I thank you for last week because I've been able to do that a little bit more.
Yeah, that's great. So again, we generally need some degree of calm in order to investigate. So it can be helpful to do that at the beginning. Or again, we need to make that determination, am I balanced enough to be mindful and be with this challenging state? And that's so we're really pointing to a few wise determinations. Is this causing damage? In the workable range, or am I a little bit stuck in an overwhelm? And if that's the case, we want to come back and have some degree of calm or presence. But then when it's there, just having that strong commitment to investigate, to see what's there, it's such a crucial part of practice. And again, for a lot of us, we get into these habits, I think, of having our meditations be these things where we kind of feel calm and peaceful, but there might not be as much investigation. Does anyone sometimes find yourself doing that? Okay. I think it's very common, isn't it? And so to remember investigation, even to just guide oneself with the eight worldly winds, for example, can really, again, I think it brings life and energy to one's practice and interests and makes it less rote if it sometimes becomes that. So. Yeah, thanks.